Thanksgiving can be the simplest of holidays. It can boil down to eat, sit, and watch football for a lot of us. Or it can be a logistical nightmare coordinating all the recipe details and your guests' culinary needs. Well, since food is on our mind as we get ready for Turkey Day, we'll be helping you along this morning with ideas, advice, and culinary moral support. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Alyssa Altman. She's the founder and author of PoorMansFeast.com, an award-winning food blog, and she's also a regular columnist for the Huffington Post and the author of the upcoming book, Poor Man's Feast, A Love Story. And we welcome your calls and your questions today. What do you need to know about how to thaw a turkey? Do you need advice for vegetarians? And what about inspiration for some new side dishes? You can shoot us your questions and your comments at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Alyssa Altman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So now, are you cooking a big feast tomorrow?
Oh no, not this time. I'm actually lucky enough to be spending Thanksgiving with my cousins in Florida, and they are cooking, and they've got it all under control. So,
and that explains why you have time to talk to us this morning.
Exactly. Otherwise, I'd be running around like no pun intended, a turkey without a head.
Well, when you think about Thanksgiving, what is on your ideal menu?
Well, there has to be, I think, unless I'm feeding a bunch of vegetarians or vegans or people who are just not poultry eaters for whatever reason, there's got to be turkey. And you know, like it, don't like it, love it, hate it. Turkey is about as an American a bird as we can get. As Adam Gopnik recently wrote, it's right up there with the bald eagle. Far more flavorful, I would think. But there has to be a lovely roast turkey. There has to be squash, butternut squash, or pumpkin in some variety. And a lot of great stuffing, and as many vegetable side dishes as the table can stand without collapsing.
Now, is Thanksgiving, do you think, the time to get jiggy if you're somebody who likes to cook, or should you try to just keep it simple and assume that people on Thanksgiving, they don't want anything to be too fancy, they just want to be satisfied?
I absolutely agree with that. I think that you can cook in interesting and creative and wild ways, if you're so inclined, at any other time of year except maybe Christmas. But I'm a big proponent of keeping it simple, not only for yourself so that you don't make yourself crazy, but also for your guests, because I think that as creative as we like to think people want us to be, I think that most celebrants and diners like to have a nod to tradition.
Didn't you once have a meal that involved stuffing foam?
I actually stuffed a pumpkin, and it was one of the greatest culinary mistakes of my life. I was actually serving. I was making Thanksgiving dinner up in Woodstock, New York, probably 20 years ago for some friends, and they were vegetarians. I was not, but I had seen Martha actually stuff a pumpkin, and so I thought I can do that. But of course, I bought the wrong kind of pumpkin, and I stuffed it with a ton of vegetables that gave off a lot of liquid. And so when I put it in the oven, it looked beautiful, and about 2 hours later, it sort of collapsed in on itself and leaked out of the oven and all over my friend's beautiful pine floors.
Oh.
So that was my lesson. I have been to some Thanksgiving dinners where there has been foam involved, and let me just say these two important words, no foam, no foam.
Well, let's start with the turkey, since that's important. Unless you're a vegetarian, and many people do that, we'll get to that. But if you want a turkey, it can be a flavorless slab of meat, What do you need to do to make it taste good?
Brine it. That's the most important thing I think that anybody can do, whether you're cooking a large bird or a small bird or a heritage bird or just a bird that you bought at your local supermarket. I think that, you can always go the route of rubbing it with compound butter underneath the skin, and that's a really wonderful thing. But to really infuse the bird with a lot of flavor, you want to brine it overnight. And
brine it overnight. Okay, that sounds like a lot of work.
It sounds like a lot of work, but it really isn't. I think the biggest challenge with brining a bird, first of all, is the bird's size, because you're dealing with something that's bigger than a chicken, and is going to require enough room in your refrigerator to hold the bird overnight in another vessel that's filled with brine. So that's the biggest challenge that most people have. But a couple of years ago, Alton Brown showed this wonderful segment about how to brine a big bird overnight and keep it cold and safe at the same time. And, it involved a gigantic cooler, like a camping cooler. It involved lining it with garbage bags and filling that with the brine and then submerging the turkey in it, and of course having ice packs underneath it. And I've done that, and it works beautifully. The key then the next day is to take the bird out of the brine, give the bird a rinse, and thoroughly dry it off, so that at that point you're starting with a nice dry bird.
So what is in the brine?
Well, brine is traditionally a compound of water, sugar, and salt. Those are the primary ingredients that go into a brine in specific proportions. You can add herbs to it. I've known people who have added a little bit of bourbon to it. I've known people who've added some maple syrup to it. And all of these things infuse the bird with more flavor than it might ordinarily have.
So what about for lazy chefs? Now, I am not the one who makes the turkey, thank God. I don't think I could handle it, especially after hearing the brining story.
Oh, sure you could.
But what about, I've heard that you can just pop it in an oven bag and that'll do the trick.
You know, that will actually help keep it moist. And I myself have never roasted a bird in a bag. I know many people who have, and they swear by it. But I do think that that if you can brine it, brining it is really the way to go.
And what about getting fancy with it? Have you ever deep fried a turkey?
Well, I have a longstanding fear of fire.
And you're a chef.
And I'm a chef, and I'm also short. So the idea of submerging a 20-pound or an 18-pound bird into a vat of boiling oil is just not my idea of a good time, especially since emergency room staff tend to be a little bit reduced during the holiday season. I have eaten deep fried turkey, and in fact, it is delicious. I mean, if you love fried chicken, you would absolutely love fried turkey. But there have been other things that I have done. Last year, I actually made a boneless roulade of turkey, which basically involved taking the entire boneless breast of the bird with the skin, laying it flat, stuffing it, rolling it, browning it, and then roasting it. And it was very impressive. It was very delicious. It was also about as dry as balsa wood.
That's too bad, because it does sound beautiful.
Yeah, I think that the key to it again is brining. And last year was the one year that I actually didn't brine it. And if I had to do it all over again, and I'm sure I will, that will be the road I'll go down.
Now, are your cousins going to brine their turkey for tomorrow?
She is going to brine. She's actually roasting two turkeys because she's expecting 24 people.
Oh, my goodness.
And unbelievably, she has just moved into her house about 5 days ago. So she's a stronger woman than I.
Well, so turkey aside, another thing people get really excited about is the dessert, which, the traditional is your pumpkin pie. But what can you do if you want to mix it up a little bit? Maybe not too fancy. What's some pumpkin alternative?
Well, we are big proponents of fruit pies, and I'm a huge fan of apple pie, of apple galettes. One of the things that we've made a couple of years ago is the traditional French style, very rustic country style galette, which basically involves slicing fruit, laying it flat, glazing it, and laying it on top of the pastry dough, and then folding the pastry dough in around it, so that what you wind up with is sort of a rectangular shaped tart, and it is really scrumptious. I have to say, it's really quite delicious.
Well, that does sound good. So the fruit. Now, you don't think fruit is out of place on a Thanksgiving dessert table?
I really don't. I mean, I do think that apple pie certainly is about as traditional as you can get beyond pumpkin pie. I have also made butternut squash galette, which is a little bit more traditional to the season. And again, that's made the same way, where we actually pureed roasted and pureed the butternut squash, and then laid it down on top of galette dough, and then folded the galette dough over it and roasted it, and it was just out of this world.
It's
a little bit more savory than the traditional pumpkin pie, but boy, it's good for dinner, it's good for dessert, it's good for breakfast.
Did you add some brown sugar and other goodies like that?
That we added a little bit of brown sugar, a little bit of cinnamon and nutmeg, tiny pinch of allspice, and we did that actually at the point at which we were roasting the butternut squash. So we halved the squash, scooped out the seeds, rubbed it with a little bit of butter, brown sugar, and the various spices, and then roasted it that way, so that by the time we then pureed it, it had been infused with those wonderful spices.
Mm. Well, this year I'm trying something new. I'm going to be making Ina Garten's recipe for pumpkin roulade, which I hope is not a mistake. I mean, it's not your pumpkin pie, and it has some candied ginger in it, but mixing it up a little bit with the pumpkin stuff, and we're foregoing the pecan pie this year. So I don't know.
And how do you think your guests will respond to that?
I don't know. It's more for me, I think.
Right.
But I mean, we'll have some other desserts. So, but the nut course. Do you think you need a nut dessert?
I don't necessarily. I mean, in my family, half of us are allergic to nuts. The answer here is no. And we actually I love pecan pie, and I came late to it because we were just not big nut lovers in my family when I was growing up. But we actually tend to save our pecan pie oddly for Easter.
For Easter?
For Easter, yeah. I don't know if that's just a Connecticut thing or what.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I mean, no one's expecting it then, so
right.
Maybe it's fresher. In terms of vegetarians, now you had that catastrophic vegetarian stuffed pumpkin.
Yes.
What else can you do for the vegetarians at your table?
I think that the most important suggestion that I could make is do not try and duplicate meat-based meals. So in other words, I am not a fan of things like forming tempeh into the shape of a bird, or forming tofu into. And the thing is that I love tofu and I love tempeh at any other time, but I don't really advocate doing that kind of thing. But this is the time when you really want your vegetables to sing and to take center stage. And if you are in fact making a Thanksgiving dinner that is entirely vegetarian, you can really sort of go to town with the best quality vegetables that you can buy, the freshest vegetables that you can buy, and really don't try and overdo. I think that my mistake with my pumpkin quagmire was that I tried to do too much that was fancy, and I tried to create a centerpiece. And this is something that I've said a lot, that in our country, we're not by nature a vegetable-driven society. We are a meat-driven society, and so we think of the big turkey or at Christmas time the standing rib roast and then all of the various vegetable side dishes. And if we remove that centerpiece, we are almost inclined to think, well, what can I do to replace it? And really, you don't really have to. I think that if you stick to simple, fresh, delicious vegetable dishes, some that you might be able to prepare ahead of time so that the oven isn't clogged, that's the way to go. If you do have some meat eaters at the table, go ahead and roast a turkey for them. They can go to town with it. But really focus on doing things that are seasonal. You can start out with something like a roasted butternut squash soup or a pumpkin bisque. I've gone so far as to even save the seeds and then toast the seeds with a tiny bit of cumin and you can use them as a garnish. One of my all-time favorite vegetable dishes, and it's really counterintuitive, but everyone I've given this recipe to just has fallen in love with it. You roast fresh Brussels sprouts in the oven until they start to turn a bright green. So that's about 10 minutes at 350. And then throw in a handful of seedless red grapes. Give the pan a shake. And what will happen is as the grapes are cooking, they will release their sugars into the dish and the Brussels sprouts will begin to caramelize. And the result, as I said, it's totally counterintuitive, but it is extraordinarily good.
So what else is in there? Just some maybe olive oil and salt?
My preference is a cast iron pan. You can throw in a handful of whole peeled garlic cloves, some salt, a pinch of pepper. I like to add thyme to it because I just love thyme. I think sage, which a lot of us tend to use a lot of over Thanksgiving, can be very strong for some people. And you get what I call the cilantro effect, where 50% of the people won't go near it, and then the other 50% of the people love it. But you put all of this in a pan. You don't have to cover it, with a little bit of olive oil. And you pop it into a 375, because Brussels sprouts tend to be quite dense. Give it a shake every couple of minutes, maybe every 10 minutes or so. And then after the first 10 minutes, throw in the grapes. You want a proportion of maybe a cup of Brussels sprouts or 2 cups of Brussels sprouts to maybe a little bit less quantity of grapes. So if you're doing 2 cups of Brussels sprouts, do a cup of grapes. And it's delicious hot. It's delicious at room temperature. It's delicious cold the next day. And it's really surprising, but truly wonderful.
That does sound fantastic. Unusual with the grapes, but I can imagine that those sugars would be nice and caramely.
You don't get a really heavy grapey flavor, and you don't get a cloying sweet flavor, but it's just enough to take the cabbagey edge off the Brussels sprouts and to give them a nice brown caramelized color.
Well, we're talking this hour with Alyssa Altman. She's the founder and author of PoorMansFeast.com, an award-winning food blog. And she's a regular food columnist for the Huffington Post and the author of the book Big Food and the forthcoming book Poor Man's Feast, A Love Story. And we're here to answer your Thanksgiving questions or provide inspiration. Wondering where you are in your preparations. Are you getting a lot done ahead of time, or does most of your cooking happen the next day? Well, let us know what you need help with this morning at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And if you're trying a little something different this year, maybe like the grapes and Brussels sprouts, let us know. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking turkey today as we get ready for the cooking and eating that is Thanksgiving. And we have our guest Alyssa Altman along. She is a founder and author of PoorMansFeast.com, quite a chef herself. And she's giving us advice on how to survive and be inspired by Thanksgiving food. And as a follow-up on the turkey brining, Alyssa, we have a caller suggesting that people not use garbage bags for brining because they have chemicals, and he suggests using food-grade bags.
That's a great suggestion.
And where would you find food-grade bags?
That's a very good question. I would guess that you could probably find them at a local chef supply store.
Okay, well, that's a good point. And then another caller wondering whether it's okay to brine a pre-basted turkey.
I wouldn't brine a pre-basted turkey because when they say pre-basted, I'm assuming that the caller purchased the turkey that way. What will happen is you're just going to wind up with a very, very salty bird. So when you want to brine something, you want to start with the freshest turkey that you can find. It's okay to have a frozen turkey that you've defrosted, give it a week to defrost in your refrigerator, but you don't want to brine something that that has already been flavored.
And let's take our first caller now. Mary is joining us from Harshaw. Hello, Mary.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a vegetarian, and I'm leaning also towards being a vegan, and it sort of bothers me a little bit about vegetarianism. People think that vegetarians just eat all vegetables and fruits, you know. But we're invited out, and my niece is going to serve turkey, but there's going to be other things to eat. But you can make like a lentil roast. You can have beans. You know, you can make a whole bunch of roasts out of legumes, lentils, even a nut roast, and provide a gravy without the meat drippings and everything. So there's a lot of recipes out there for vegans and vegetarians that you don't have to just have a whole lot of vegetables for your meal.
Right. Well, thank you, Mary. That's a good point. I mean, we always have anywhere from 1 to 4 vegetarians at our Thanksgiving table, and they often get by on just this beautiful bounty of side dishes that include vegetables and a lot more.
Right, right. And she's actually, you know, quite correct. I mean, I think that we tend to overlook the fact of the wonderful beans and grains and in many cases heirloom beans. I'm thinking of the wonderful Rancho Gordo beans that come from California through a fellow named Steve Sando, and there are tons of other companies who are creating and saving heirloom varieties of beans. And recently we actually made lentil-based meatballs, quote-unquote meatballs or lentil balls, and they were extraordinarily delicious. Hmm. And, you know, if you're looking for meat, and I am a meat eater, although I am, in fact, trying to cut back, if you're looking for meat and you're expecting meat, you will in fact be disappointed. But if you go into it knowing that you're eating something different, then I think that there's certainly a lot out there. There are wonderful grains to be cooked with. There's quinoa, there's farro, which I adore farro. There's kasha and barley and pearled barley and whole barley, and every kind of bean, dried bean is available in your local supermarket.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mary, and have a happy Thanksgiving. We'll move next to Michelle in Partyville. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Veronica and Alyssa. I'm calling. I was just wondering if she could suggest some sort of a dressing that could go on the turkey, like a mango salsa, or my kids aren't real big on the cranberry, but I wanted to make some sort of a little sauce to have something real simple that I can saute up in a pan to put on top of the turkey.
So something besides the gravy you're looking for?
Yeah, just something a little different.
Okay.
Now you're looking for something besides the gravy or instead of the gravy?
No, I am still going to make gravy because that's a staple on the table. You got to have the mashed potatoes and gravy. But just I'm not going to eat the gravy myself, and the kids don't like cranberry, so I just thought if I had a sauce to put on the turkey.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly, something like a mango salsa is really delicious and easily made, and, you know, you can certainly go the mango route, you can go the clementine route. Clementines are everywhere this time of year. It sounds, a lot of kids don't particularly go for cranberries because they have that sort of bitter edge to them. But you can absolutely make a sort of a fruit salsa with mango, with clementine. You can make something called a salsa verde, which is a green Mexican sauce that's not really spicy, but is very, very flavorful. And is delicious on any meat, any poultry, and any fish, which of course you're probably not serving at Thanksgiving. But there are, you know, there are many, many options, and a good, you know, a good base for a salsa is chopped red onion, the fruit, the juice from the fruit, and a little bit of for me anyway, for hot chilies, and that of course will push the turkey in a more Mexican direction, but if they, you know, if they're fine with that, then I would say go for it.
I like your idea of the clementines, kind of like a little bit of a citrusy that I, because one time I brined a turkey and I used lemons and limes, and I like that idea. That's an excellent idea.
Great.
Great, right, Mary. Well, good luck with that. I hope your kids like it.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm going to try your Brussels sprout and grapes. I think that sounds fantastic.
Excellent. Thank you.
We are wondering, well, I should say there's a couple listeners wondering about where to find a copy of that Brussels sprout grape recipe. Is it online somewhere?
It should be online somewhere, but I can send it off to you, and you can send it off to your listeners today.
Well, we will post it on our Facebook page. If you send it to us, we will make sure to get it up there today at the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page.
Excellent.
So, great. Let's go to our next caller. Mary is joining us in Green Bay. Welcome.
Good morning. I am going to make my husband's favorite cranberry jelly, and I realized this year that I gave away my stainless steel pans, and I was always cautioned by Aunt Minnie, Great Aunt Minnie, to only make it in stainless steel pans. Will it gel if it's in a Califalon no-stick pan?
And if it's in a no-stick pan, I think you'll be fine. I think you now, do you add gelatin to it at all?
No.
Okay. I think you'll be fine. I think that the key to cooking with acidic foods, and why you generally want to cook acidic foods in a non-reactive or stainless steel pan, is because they will actually turn. In some cases, they'll discolor. It's the same reason why you would not cook tomatoes in anything, for example, a raw aluminum pan. Why you always have to cook tomato in a coated cast iron, or enameled cast iron, or stainless steel, or a stick-proof pan. So cranberries are extremely acidic, And that's probably the reason why she recommended staying with stainless steel. But as long as you're cooking in a coated pan, you'll be fine.
Thank you.
Great. Well, good luck, Mary. And let's take our next call from Randy, joining us from Ripon. Hello, Randy.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a comment and a question, and I just wanted to say that some of my fondest memories, and I'm 55 years old, were at my grandparents' farm, an aunt and uncle's farm, with a traditional turkey and all the other foods that went with it. To me, those kind of meals have become exotic. I just don't see those anymore. Those folks have long passed away. But for me, I've been doing the turkeys, and you brought the turkey in a bag, which to me is a win-win situation. I've never had moisture turkeys, but to satisfy my girlfriend and other folks, I'm going to try doing it in a roasting pan. But I'm just wondering, my question is there a marinade? Is that a good idea or a bad idea? And if so, what type of marinade would you recommend?
Well, my immediate thought of, if you are going to put it in a roasting pan, and again, I myself have not cooked a turkey in a bag, but I know a lot of people who have, and I've eaten turkey that's been cooked in a bag, and it is, in fact, the benefit is extreme moisture. And turkey, by its nature, it is a game bird. By its history, it's a game bird. So it tends to be drier in the way that pheasant tends to be drier. But when you're putting it in a roasting pan, what's happening is you are effectively what we call dry roasting it. So the first thing I would do is I would brine it overnight if you can brine it overnight. There are some wonderful, wonderful brining recipes that are available pretty much everywhere right now, and it's really indeed a simple method. If you've got a second refrigerator, if you have the benefit of a second refrigerator, you can store it in that refrigerator overnight. And when you take it out of the brine, create a compound butter. In other words, take an unsalted butter in it. It really must be unsalted, and bring it to room temperature so that it gets nice and soft. And add to the butter a little bit of minced shallot, a little bit of white pepper, some fresh chopped herbs. Thyme is great. Rosemary tends to be a little bit strong, but if you add it with a light hand, you'll be fine. And mix that together, and take your hand and scoop up the butter and massage the bird's flesh between the skin and the bird. So what you'll wind up with is a bird that, you've got the skin, then you've got a layer of the butter, then you've got the actual turkey meat. And when you roast it, what will happen is that butter will effectively baste the bird from the inside out. You also want to create a basting liquid, and it can be anything from a little bit of butter mixed with some turkey stock, wine. Some people like a very, very dark glaze. You can add some bourbon to it. You can add some maple to it. And about, I would say, 15 to 20 minutes before the bird comes out of the oven, or even a half an hour, begin to baste it. If you baste it earlier, that baste will burn during the roasting process, and you don't want to have that happen. But the other point is that when you're dry roasting it, part of the bird will cook faster than the other. So if the breast starts to brown faster than the legs, and that will happen, have a good roll of heavy-duty tinfoil available, and just loosely tent the top of the bird in the earliest stages of cooking, so that you don't wind up with a burnt breast while the legs are cooking.
Great. Well, some wonderful specifics there. I like the idea of the butter with the shallots and the pepper and the herbs. That sounds delicious.
It is wonderful. And one of the best turkeys I've ever had was a brine turkey that had been massaged heavily massaged with herb butter, a compound butter, before roasting.
And a question here about the brining of the turkey. This is from Phil, who says, the forecast here in Madison says it will be in the upper 30s overnight. Will it be cold enough to brine a turkey outside overnight?
I wouldn't. I know that some people probably would say it's probably going to be fine. I tend to err on the side of caution. If there's any way that he can manage to bring it in and put it in a refrigerator or a second refrigerator, or do the the ice method where you line a cooler with bags and have the ice sitting under the bags. And put the turkey, as your other caller suggested, in a cooking grade bag. That would be the way to go.
Darn, that's a good idea Phil had there.
it's cold. Cold weather is a real lure. I know that a lot of people up your way will in fact do it. I'm in Florida right now. So,
yeah, do not try this in Florida.
Don't try it in Florida.
We are talking this hour with Alyssa Altman, founder and author of PoorMansFeast.com, an award-winning food blog, and she's got a book coming out. It's called Poor Man's Feast, A Love Story. And she's here today to answer your Thanksgiving questions and give you some inspiration for how to survive in good style. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and the email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, I'm back with you this Wednesday morning. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network as we talk about Thanksgiving food with our guest, Alyssa Altman, who's founder and author of Poor Man's Feast, also a chef in and of her own right. And we're taking your phone calls now. We'll go next to Pat, joining us from Monticello. Hi, Pat.
Good morning,
morning.
Veronica. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I attend a family gathering, and every year I'm asked to bring my vegan gravy, which smells and looks like beef gravy, so all the vegetarians there can enjoy gravy on their mashed potatoes. I've even taken the broth that's the base for this, put sliced mushrooms in it, and served it as a beef mushroom soup to people, and they didn't know the difference.
Ah, well, what's in it?
Well, there's tamari, kitchen bouquet, nutritional yeast flakes, chopped onions, rubbed sage, and 2 cups of water. And you simmer it for 5 minutes, and it's done. I actually do have a blog, which is not an award-winning blog, but I share my recipe with friends. I think I have one follower right now. And the recipe is on there. So if anybody's interested to see it, it really is easy. It's delicious, and I love mashed potatoes with gravy. So
sure. What is your blog address?
It's called Love Ya The Mom, loveyathemom.blogspot.com.
Love Ya The Mom.
Love Ya The Mom.
That sounds great. That sounds wonderful.
And I would say that vegetarian, I don't know, I haven't had a vegan, or have I think that vegetarian gravies and vegan gravies can be just as delicious as meat gravies, having had both. And there are some people at our table who prefer the vegetarian.
Absolutely.
And mushrooms, I know you write about mushrooms being a good meat replacement, too. They're meaty, they have that earthy quality, and adding them to a gravy sounds perfect for Thanksgiving.
They're wonderful.
And we have, let's see, let's take this question in email form, who has Terry wondering about serving and preparing a whole smoked pheasant. He bought it frozen.
Wow. Smoked pheasant. That's not a question I get a lot of. preparing it. I've made smoked pheasant on a couple of occasions, and what you want to do is you want to thaw it slowly and carefully, the way you would thaw a turkey. I would say a pheasant obviously is significantly smaller. I would defrost it in the refrigerator, give it a good couple of days. And I would leave it, I would leave it in its wrapping, let it defrost in its wrapping, take it out, and I would do as little to it as humanly possible. Smoked pheasant is extremely flavorful. The fact that it's been smoked, it has been pre-cooked. That does not mean that you shouldn't cook it again. You should absolutely roast it, bring it to the internal temperature should be 165 degrees. And because it's smoked and because it's a gamey flavored and earthy flavored bird, I would do less to it in terms of basting with anything, you know, more than butter, because what will happen is you'll wind up with flavors that compete with the smokiness, and that's not something that you want to do. The other thing I would do is I would make sure that the other dishes that you're serving with it go easy on the salt with it. Because okay. a smoked meat, it's not cured, but smoked meat tends to be saltier.
And there you go, something unusual, smoked pheasant, which maybe that will be a new alternative down the road. Let's go to Brad, calling from Whiting next. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. I eat sweet potatoes every day. I bake them at 485 for about an hour and a half. But at least half of the time, they turn out not being sweet at all and are completely unpalatable, even if I cook them an extra hour. Is there a surefire way to cook sweet potatoes or steam them so that they'll come out sweet every time?
Well, my first question is, are you in fact buying sweet potatoes? You may be buying yam, which are thought to be, in our lexicon, we often confuse the two. And you can go into a supermarket that will have what appear to be sweet potatoes for sale, and they will in fact be yams. And then you can go into another supermarket and have the reverse be true. And yams, in many cases, are not sweet. Anything that's marked white sweet potato is generally not sweet. It's earthy. It's a little bit, I don't want to say chewier, but it's quite a different consistency than the traditional sweet potato that you and I are more used to. So the first thing I would do is make sure that you are in fact getting a sweet potato. Second thing, even if it is a sweet potato, not all of them are as sweet as we'd like them to be, in the same way that sometimes during the summer you'll get a peach and it'll be really wonderful and you'll get all that sort of peach juice dripping down your chin, and other times it'll be like taking a bite out of a cotton ball. So it really depends on where it's grown, the way it's been grown, the environment in which it's grown. But if you want to take control and sort of push the sweetness, what I would do is I would split the sweet potato, or take a whole sweet potato and poke it with the fork, I would say a good 10 times, 5 times on each side, wrap it up in aluminum foil, pop it in the oven. 480 seems to be, I think it might be a little bit high, so I would reduce that to maybe 425 or 400, and let it roast slowly. When you take it out, scoop it out of the shell or cut it in half, and you can drizzle a little bit of maple syrup on it. You can sprinkle maple sugar on it, which is quite delicious, or agave, which is my personal favorite. Honey, I think, competes with it. But my primary suggestion would be to make sure that, in fact, what you're buying is sweet potato.
Great. Well, thank you, Brad, and I hope that helps. Good luck with your sweet potatoes on Thanksgiving. And we'll move next to Adam. Adam joins us from Marinette. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Veronica.
Sure.
This is a great show. This is a really fun time of year to be thinking about food.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to share a recipe that I may or may not have fabricated a couple weeks ago for a potluck, and it was, I have a pretty big garden, and so I've got a lot of different things on hand, and what I've been doing with squash is I'll roast it at something like 400 degrees, like what you would typically roast a squash at, but then in the meantime I'll pan fry just a ton of garlic and onions, and if I have time, I'll pull the squash out, fill the squash with the onions and garlic, and I'll continue to roast it, and then afterwards, I'll pull the whole thing out and have a pretty large, ideally a really large cast iron skillet hot with either oil or butter at the bottom, and I'll scoop the whole mixture into the pan and kind of mix it up and fry it until it's nice and crispy, usually like a high heat, because what I'm going for is really like a crispy outer crust, and ultimately what I end up with is kind of like a potato pancake.
Wow.
Situation. And so and then incorporating any number of herbs that you have on hand are kind of nice too. Sage is a nice accompaniment, otherwise just literally salt and pepper, and it's kind of a different way, a different variation of incorporating butter into your roasted squash. And and another suggestion I was going to make, I grow a lot of potatoes and a lot of cabbage, and so I eat a lot of what I would consider poor man's mashed potatoes, because I don't always have milk on hand, but I'll still boil them and mash them, and then again, I won't always have ingredients for gravy on hand, so I'll put just sauerkraut on top of my mashed potatoes, and that for vegetarians and or vegans is kind of a kind of a cool alternative to, I mean, maybe that's my German ancestry.
Potatoes and cabbage are a really, really stellar marriage. They're, I think, enormously underrated and just so delicious, especially at this time of year.
And thanks for that recipe, Adam. You're right. That does sound delicious. And as long as we're talking about roasting squash, Alyssa, what is the best way to roast squash? Should you peel it and kind of chunk it up first, or should you just roast it in the skin and then scoop?
Well, I have personally not had a whole lot of luck peeling winter squash. I actually have grown. I grew squash this past year, and the skin, because it was fresher and they were slightly smaller, the skin was a tiny bit thinner, and that was okay. You know, using a straight sort of locked root vegetable peeler will work. Swivel peelers, I find, don't generally work very well with winter squash. If you're going the route of something like a delicata squash, which is a long oval-shaped squash and sweet and delicious, and as the name indicates, quite delicate, I have roasted it and not only not peeled it, but the skin is absolutely edible, and that's wonderful. If you are roasting something like a big butternut squash or an acorn squash or Hubbard squash, I would be a little bit careful about peeling it. What I tend to do is I tend to split the squash in half, or if it's really big, into thirds or into wedges, scoop out the seeds, rub it with a little bit of olive oil, salt, and pepper, put it in a roasting pan that has the tiniest amount of water, maybe a quarter of an inch of water in the bottom of the pan, and then cover it with foil and roast it that way, because squash has natural sugars in it, and if you put it in a dry pan, very often, not always, but very often, it will burn. And the water facilitates even cooking. It roasts. It's a wet roast, so it almost steams, so it's a little bit more tender, and it also keeps it from burning.
Okay, well, those are great tips for the squash roasting. Thank you. And this just in, a caller says she checked and found out that big Ziploc bags are okay for brining turkeys.
Great. Excellent.
So that's something which you could find at most grocery stores. That makes it a little easier.
This is true. Unless you're roasting something like a 20-pounder, if you can find a bag big enough for a 20-pound turkey, that's terrific.
They make them that big. You would not believe how big baggies have gotten.
Big enough to hold a Volkswagen, right?
Pretty much, yeah. All right, let's go to another call as we near the end of the hour here with Mary from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Okay, I have a quick question. I am getting two organic turkeys, and they're both going to be about 12 pounds. They didn't have a 20-pound one, so I'm getting two. When I cook them, do I look at how much time it takes for 20 pounds or 24 pounds or 12 pounds, or how much time?
12 pounds. Now, do you have double ovens, or are you going to be roasting them side by side?
Side by side.
What you want to do is you want to treat them as the birds they are, and just roast them as though you were roasting two 12-pound birds. But again,
yeah.
You know, I think the key is, keep an eye on them, and make sure that you roast them until they get to an internal temperature of 165 degrees.
Okay.
When you take them out, put them on a board, cover them with foil, loosely cover them with foil, and let them rest. I can't be more emphatic. I know a lot of people take their turkey out of the oven. Everybody's waiting. Everybody's hungry. You know, the football games are over, and they just carve right into it, and then they complain that it's dry. And the reason is that if you don't let the turkey rest, literally rest, I would say for 12-pound birds, I would say anywhere from 10 to 20 minutes.
Okay.
It will not get cold. And remember, if you're serving a warm gravy with it, it's going to be fine. But what will happen if you don't do that is the juices that have accumulated during the cooking process will actually run out of the bird and you're going to leave all of that delicious flavor on the board.
And that would be a shame.
And that would be a shame. And remember, you know, the juicier the bird, the better the leftovers are going to be.
Well, good luck, Mary. We hope you have good luck with your twin turkeys there. And Alyssa Altman, thank you to you. It's been a great hour, and I wish you a very happy and yummy Thanksgiving.
And to you as well. Thank you so much.
Alyssa Altman, the founder and author of PoorMansFeast.com and the forthcoming book, Poor Man's Feast, A Love Story. I'm Veronica Rickert, wishing you a happy Thanksgiving on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.